This is an interview with Betty Roberts. This is tape 5, side B. It was in 1962 that you went on, as you said, to law school. And I know that you've talked a little bit about that, but why was it that you were deciding to get a law degree? What was your...
I think we talked about the fact that I had gotten a master's degree in political science at the University of Oregon, and that I had been denied it, the opportunity to work on a PhD there. And I think I also said that I just was not through learning and that I wanted to seek more education, and that the Knight Law School was here. And while I didn't at that point think about being a lawyer, I nevertheless felt that I would like to go to law school, that I would like to continue to stretch my brain, if you will, and be a student and continue to educate myself in some way. As I went on through law school, I then began to realize that maybe I would be a lawyer, that I might want to practice, and it might be a very fascinating thing to do. So I modified that feeling a great deal during the 4 years that I was in law school. And by the time I was through with law school, then I certainly did want to take the bar exam, and I certainly did want to pass, and I wanted to practice law. And some things happened along the way, however, I think, to also motivate me in that direction, and that is that I met Keith Skelton, who is my husband now and has been for almost 24 years. I met Keith in the legislature. I think I had met him once in the campaign, the fall campaign in 64. It was a presidential election year, as I recall. I think Hubert Humphrey was in town, and it was some sort of a political rally. And I met Keith. Simply, he said to me, "You've been elected to the legislature. Congratulations. If there's anything I can do, let me know." And I thought, well, nice guy. I'll look forward to working with him. Then when I went to the legislature in 65, of course, Keith was there. We began to get acquainted, but no differently than I began to get acquainted with all the other legislators and with all the lobby. We did later in the session, Keith invited me to for dinner, but he knew I was in law school and that I rarely ever stayed in Salem. But I told him, and we laugh about this a great deal, he had been in the legislature for two sessions, in 57 and 59, and Keith had stayed out of the legislature in 61 and 63 in order to lobby for what was then called the three-way workers' compensation law revision. So now he was back in the legislature in 65 from Lane County, determined to get that piece of legislation passed, and that he would simply work on it from the inside rather than being a lobbyist for some of the insurance interests. And I was not going to support his proposal to change the workers' compensation law. Not that I knew very much about it, but unions had supported me. They were opposed to it. So while I was willing to try to understand the issue and to learn about it, I felt certain that I was going to vote with most of the Democrats. Most of the Democrats, although Keith's a Democrat, were opposed to changing the law. So when he said, "Well, would you stay down some time and go to dinner with me?" And I said, "Well, I'd have to be on a Tuesday or Thursday night. Then I, you know, would have to leave and get home because I have to go home every night." And he said, "That's fine, you know, we'll work it out." And I said, "But one thing, no point in you lobbying me on the workers' comp bill," because I thought that was why he was inviting me to go to dinner,
right,
is that he was simply wanted my ear for an hour or so to explain the workers' comp and why I should vote on his side. And so I said, "I will go to dinner, but I don't want any lobbying about the workers' compensation bill." And he said, "Really, that's not why I'm asking you for dinner." And he tells me now, and has told me a long time ago, when we chuckle about this, he said, "I didn't need your vote. I already had the votes. I wasn't about to lobby you on the workers' compensation law. So I said, okay, you know, but that was what I thought his motive was.
Did he say why he wanted to take you to dinner?
Just to get acquainted, mm-hmm. and just because he was beginning to think that he sort of liked this woman legislator, and so we just get a little bit better acquainted. Mm-hmm. And I did find out, of course, that he had four children, and then later in the session learned that he was separating from his wife, and so we began then to have much more direction toward each other, I guess, in terms of, well, what are you like and what are you like,
right.
Kind of thing. And so our relationship then began to blossom a bit by sort of toward the end of the legislature and certainly into the summer.
Since we're just starting to talk about your law school, I thought that you were indicating that Keith in some way was encouraging
you're
you.
Right. You're right. I was. That's what prompted me to go back and talk about Keith.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that in that legislative session, Keith was very, he was teaching at the University of Oregon, and he was practicing attorney in Eugene. Of course, I was a teacher then, and thinking about becoming a practicing lawyer. He would ask me how law school was going. One incident that I remember very clearly was when I told him that as good as could be expected under all the circumstances, but that I was having a hell of a time with a course which we called then negotiable instruments. And he said, I can teach you negotiable instruments in an hour. And I sort of said to myself, what kind of a rush is this, you know, new line here?
Yeah.
So he said, seriously, I can. He said, I teach this stuff all the time. So we decided one day at noon to go out and sit on one of the benches out on the Capitol grounds. And he gave me a lecture on negotiable instruments. And I got to ask questions, and he made it really very simple and very much in lay terms, because at that point I really was a lay person. I was just learning this. And he just went through the whole course and in a very clear, you know, outlined sort of way, allowing me to ask questions as we went. And it really was a good good instruction.
Yeah.
And so I developed then some respect for Keith in terms of his teaching ability, because it was obvious that I'd learned a lot. And in fact, I did get an A out of that course. I even learned that I liked the course because it was pretty mathematical. You know, everything fell into place. There weren't a lot of, well, this is the rule and this is the exception, you know, this is the rule, period. You know, it's just a very predictable type subject area in the law. And so Keith and I did have some of those kinds of interesting give and take. And so we certainly got acquainted early on as a couple of professionals. Me not yet a lawyer by profession, but certainly eager, getting more eager, becoming more eager to be one.
Was there?
I think Keith influenced me a lot by being a lawyer himself, but also being a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I started looking at the possibility of being a lawyer but continuing my teaching in some way.
Was there any indication that after you finished law school, you might have a position with his law firm?
Oh, no. No, no, never, because he was in Eugene. I was in Portland. I was elected from Portland. I wasn't going to give up my political base to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was never, ever any thought of it at all.
But eventually you were connected with this law firm.
Well,
you?
Eventually what happened was that then after Frank and I were divorced and after he was divorced, after Keith was divorced, then we started seeing each other on a very regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And we started talking about marriage, and I said, wait a minute, you know, I need some time. I've done it twice. And he, in fact, he and his wife had numerous separations, but had always gone back.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had pretty rocky time, too, in his marriage. And I just said, we'll talk about it, you know, but I need some time. And so finally in 67, he decided he was going to move to Portland, that while his family was still divorced from his wife, but still had some family in Eugene, they were getting older. His oldest daughter had graduated from the University of Oregon. Another daughter was in the University of Oregon. Then, the oldest son was getting out of high school and going on. And so he decided that he would move to Portland because he would like to teach at Portland State. They gave him a job. And he would like to practice law in Portland. So he moved here in 67 and ran in 68 from Multnomah County for the legislature. And that was the year that I ran for the Senate. And I won my Senate race. He won his race for the House, even though he changed from Lane County up to Multnomah County. So we were married in 68 and went to the legislature then together in 69 as married. He was in the House and I was in the Senate.
Did he know he was going to run for the legislature when he moved
up here? You bet. He knew it so well. He knew he'd already picked out the person he was going to run against and had to live in that district. And
By this time they had formed the district.
Yes. And we had not single-member districts. We still had the five districts, but we had the position numbering so that each candidate selected their opposing opponent in the other party.
How confusing. It seems confusing.
Well.
How did that evolve?
Well, first of all, we had, running in a pack of districts. Then each sitting House member and senator were assigned a position on the ballot for the next election.
What kind of a position?
A number. So, for example, in East Central, here where he ran, there were four House members. Each House member who was then in the legislature was assigned either position one, position two, three, or four.
And how was that position determined?
In East Central District. And it was simply determined, as I recall, by the Secretary of State's office.
By what criteria? Was there any criteria?
Seniority? No. Well, it didn't really matter. It didn't really matter because all four positions were equal. And so it was just maybe it was done alphabetically. I have no idea.
It didn't make any difference.
Didn't make any difference whether it was position one or position four that one ran for, because the difference was who is in that position. And Fred Meek, who was a Republican, had served from this district, this East Central district, for a number of years. Keith just said, "I'm going to run against Fred Meek. He's a very ineffective legislator. He's got a whale of a name, historical name, for Oregon. But I think that I can out-campaign him."
But you could choose any one of those four to run against.
Yes. And what happened was that everyone who was interested in running in a particular district would usually, in that party, they would get together and say, okay, who's going to take on this person? We all want to run from East Central. The same year that Keith ran here, Harl Haas ran in this district. Corbett,
Ellis?
No, the real Corbett from the Corbett family.
Alf Corbett.
Not Alf, woman.
Oh.
Woman. She's been on she was on the staff at Portland State in the administration for some
time. Was her name Corbett?
Yes, I'm trying to think. Kay Corbett. She's married to Henry Corbett of the Corbett, the big Corbett family. Kay decided to run. In here, even though she lived on the west side, I presume it wasn't necessary for her to be a resident. All of this is in, the old election law evolvement up to single-member districts. So they just sort of decided who was going to take on which Republican. And Keith had already staked out Fred Meek and let that be known that that was the person he wanted to run against. And so they all looked around for somebody else because they didn't want a primary battle. You know, if another Democrat had run, then that person would have had to run against Keith. So sometimes it was a question of just who filed first. And then someone else who wanted to also run in that district had to take on, you know, a different candidate. It was a fascinating time. It was evolving from the multi-district idea where it was the top three or four that won to then position numbering so you could actually take on an opponent. And then after that, to single-member districts.
When was the single-member districts?
I think single-member districts, I'm not sure, Clark. I need to do some research on that. But I think that the single-member districts occurred after the 72 election. I think that was the first time that we had single-member districts.
And was that only happening in Multnomah County? Or was it happening throughout the state?
Oh, it was happening throughout the state.
The same kind of...
I believe so.
There must have been a lot of challenges to the election systems during that time.
You mean legal challenges?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was also during the time that we were developing the Corrupt Practices Act in the legislature. And I'm not sure about the date that year either. But because there were some election reforms going on, about what candidates could do and not do, and the requirement of reporting your campaign income and expenditures, contributions and expenditures, and what elections, the outcome of elections could be challenged on, deceptive campaign practices and so on. All of those things had also been being worked on in the legislature, and so then the revision of how people got elected to the legislature sort of coincided with that, and it was an interesting period of time.
Yeah.
I mean, we accept it now, the Campaign Corrupt Practices Act, and we accept single-member districts, but it was an evolution that occurred over about a 10 or 12 year period there.
Mm-hmm. Was this something that was happening simultaneously around the country, or?
Oh, sure. Yes. Yeah. Oregon certainly was not operating in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
It was happening all over the country, and that's a part of kind of the revolution in politics that was taking place during that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more. The idea was more participation. Single member districts will allow an individual to really talk with the voter. Voter will really know who his or her elected representative is, quote, supposed to be better government. That's all debatable, and was then, still is, because legislators then tend to get very provincial and say, I don't have to depend upon any other interest to get me elected except my people in this small little district.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't then see the big issue, they only see their little small district issue. And that has, that, you know, we could debate whether single-member districts are good or bad forever. And we debated it then long and hard, and people are still kind of debating it.
Mm-hmm. While you were in law school, what were your views of government and the role of the government in society at that time, and did your experiences in law school, I'm thinking of your pre-legislature experience in terms of how you viewed government as opposed to maybe how you felt about it later and before you went onto the bench.
Well, certainly my personal experiences as a child and the Franklin Roosevelt era and my study of political science influenced my philosophy about government and how I viewed government more than my law school experiences. The Northwestern School of Law, or College of Law, I guess as it was called, was unique in that it had no full-time faculty. In the people who taught us were practicing attorneys.
Hmm.
The And therefore, our courses were very practically oriented, which was disappointing to me because I would have loved to have had some courses on philosophy of the law and some background. I think that that just focusing only on the how you practically go about studying these courses was a serious omission in my legal education. But that's the way it was taught, and it was expected that the people who took those courses were simply going to go out there and practice. And so we didn't do any theory, we didn't do any background, we didn't do any historical. Had no courses that sort of set the stage.
Was it geared for the bar exam?
Yes. Yes, and geared for, by all means, for the bar exam. In other words, just to get lawyers out there as lawyers. So my philosophy of government was certainly one in which I felt government had to take responsibility for helping citizens who could not help themselves and trying to get them into a point where they could help themselves. That, you know, school lunch programs, certain welfare programs, health care programs, so on, were paramount issues that I was concerned about.
How did you feel at the time about the limits of government involvement in
Well, I have I know that what I say, that government is supposed to do some of the, in my mind, supposed to do some of these things. I also felt very strongly about government not becoming involved in people's personal lives. And had a good background in constitutional law from my political science courses, where, and in fact, had one course at the University of Oregon in which there were three professors, one a sociologist, one a psychologist, and one a law professor, who in the seminar, and the law professor was Hans Lindy, who was teaching then at University of Oregon, who I later served with on the Supreme Court. They were sort of a team to talk about some areas of society and the law. And Hans came from his strong constitutional law background and brought that into that course. So I think that though I studied constitutional law from an application of the law, as a lawyer, I'd already had the background through the political science courses that certainly affected my philosophy on that issue of, you know, the civil liberties and government staying out of areas where it should not regulate human behavior.
And how would you describe your political views at this point?
At this point, quite liberal in civil liberties areas, and I would guess pretty moderate on economic issues. And in fact, I think that my position in my sort of moderate position on economic issues was a real surprise to people when I was first in the House of Representatives. Because as a woman who was teaching school, and therefore a professional woman who was earning her own income, I was expected to be, quote, more radical by others than I really was. But once those people in the legislature who were a little bit more conservative understood where I was coming from, they respected me a lot more as a person who would not go overboard on issues, but would think rationally, logically, try to figure them out and try to persuade people rather than just being what I guess we now and then call the knee-jerk liberal.
But what does moderate mean to you?
What does moderate mean to me? Moderate means being a little suspicious of either end of the political spectrum. And not only being suspicious of either end, because if you have a person who's so conservative they become reactionary, mm-hmm. or you have a person who is so liberal that they become anarchist, you know, both of them are very very destructive type. Anarchist, of course, is no government at all. And the other one is so authoritarian that the people have no say in that form of government. But they both become the same in their tactics. They both use violence, they both use force, and so on to achieve what they think, you know, is the proper thing to do. Moderate to me is being able to see both sides of an issue and then to think clearly about that issue. And so from the standpoint of thinking about economic issues or taxation issues or environmental issues or that sort of thing, it's more of a long-range approach rather than maybe just a case-by-case approach as it is when we're dealing with civil liberties, which usually only come up because of some incident or some long-time historical development of such as mm-hmm. the racial relations in this country. To me, they're compatible because we want a strong economy. If we don't have a strong economy, the minorities in our society will not benefit as well as mm-hmm. those who have the power will not benefit. But on the other hand, we have to be civil libertarians so that we can give everybody the benefit of our of the opportunities that exist in our government. That's not really a concise statement about what's moderate, but it is just being reasonable and rational, mm-hmm. listening to both sides, mm-hmm. and then saying, I'm not going to go to either extreme. I'm going to, you know, try to figure this thing out and have some sort of a political philosophy. Mm-hmm. I always felt really quite disturbed with legislators who seemed to have a political philosophy, but when they had to apply it, it didn't come through. And I can give you an example. In the 67 session in the House, we had one at-large seat, and Berkeley Lent held that seat in Multnomah County. After reapportionment, it had been decided that Multnomah County should have another legislative seat, but instead of assigning that seat to one of the five already created districts, it was just an at-large seat. And so Bud Lent had run at that at-large seat, and he was serving in the legislature from all of Multnomah County, because everybody in Multnomah County had voted for him, or had voted on in that race. I put in a bill to have that seat assigned to East Multnomah County, which was the most rapidly growing area of Multnomah County. It had the population to deserve that seat so that then it would be more equally divided. And when my bill got out of committee and came to the floor, I was lining up votes. And I went to Wally Priestley, who was one of the most flaming liberals and in the legislature, and a very interesting but sometimes unpredictable person. I went to Wally and I said, Wally, I need your vote to get this fourth House seat out in East Multnomah County. And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, Betty, I can't do that to my good old friend Bud Lent. And I said, Wally, you're the one who has been on the soapbox talking about one man, one vote, equal representation. Mm-hmm. And I said, you of all people, I would have thought would have voted for this bill, because you can see by these figures that East Multnomah County has the population to have that seat. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we're underrepresented from East Multnomah County. But he held fast and he said, sorry, Bud's my friend. I just said, okay, Wally, now you see why Tennessee couldn't And that was a famous U.S. Supreme Court case that told legislators they had to reapportion themselves according to population. I said, now you see why the Tennessee legislature could not draw its own redistricting, and the court had to do it for them because they couldn't do it to their friends. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. you know, that kind of, you like some predictability with the people that you're working with. And some legislators come there with enough of a political philosophy that they are predictable. I mean, you want them to be predictable on so they agree with you. But if they don't agree with you, you at least want to know whether they're going to be a vote on the other side so that you can sort of plan your strategy, attempt to convince them on some logical argument, and then hope that they can be persuaded to your position by some reasoning. But people who have no political philosophy at all, just, you know, they go from one side to the other, and it's maybe what...